Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Donald Trump comes to town, and his 90-minute speech was an example of reverting to form. The shakeup on the Democratic ticket has people speculating about Kamala Harris's choice for VP. Roy Cooper's name is on that list. Crime, particularly youth crime, is up substantially in Charlotte. We share CMPD statistics. Meanwhile, a new Chetty study is released. The original one shocked Charlotte, revealing serious upward mobility issues. This one is a little different. And the Paris Olympics are underway with several athletes from this area in the Games. Here to talk about those stories and more is Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV and host of their Sunday morning program, Flashpoint. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning. Welcome to you all.
Happy Friday.
Happy morning.
Good to be here. Exactly.
Well, this week, Donald Trump, this is no news, I suppose, but Donald Trump held a rally in Charlotte at Bojangles Coliseum. He alluded to the new, kinder, gentler Donald Trump that many said would come from the attempt on his life in Pennsylvania a few weeks ago.
You know, I was supposed to be nice. They say something happened to me when I got shot. I became nice. And when you're dealing with these people, they're very dangerous people. When you're dealing with them, you can't be too nice. You really can't be. So if you don't mind, I'm not going to be nice. Is that okay?
I'm not gonna. Okay, well, that didn't last long. This is red meat classic Trump, but his supporters never seem to tire of it. This was an evening rally, but the crowds began forming, I'm told, at 5 o'clock in the morning at Bojangles Coliseum. What was the attendance like for this rally?
It was packed, 11,000 people, yeah. I think, something like that. Yeah. There were reports of some people, I think it was about 44 people who had heat-related illnesses from being out there for so long, and then there were some who ultimately didn't get into the rally because of the size of the crowd. So, yeah, he definitely brought out his loyal supporters in Charlotte.
Yeah, 13 people went to the hospital, I'm told, one in critical condition. What do we know about those folks this morning? Did they all recover properly?
As far as I know, I have not seen anything different.
Okay. What is capacity at Bojangles Coliseum? Because about 1,000 people, I understand, did not get in because it was full.
The reported capacity the other night for the event was 11,000, which is, that sounds plausible because you can get about 8,300 in there for hockey and you figure that there's nothing on the floor except people. So that would make sense.
So as expected, he went after President Biden and his presumptive new opponent, Vice President Harris, and his comments on Biden ranged from the true.
He quit because he was losing so badly in the polls. He was down in every single poll and down by a lot, so he quit.
From the true to personal invective, saying that Biden was a fake liberal and that Harris is a real liberal, and he singled her out for not telling the truth about Biden.
For 3.5 years, Harris shamelessly lied to the public to cover up Joe Biden's mental unfitness, claiming that Crooked Joe was at the absolute top of his game. I don't think so. I don't think so. I wish him well, but I don't like him. He's not a nice person.
And, of course, he wasted no time in turning his invective toward his new opponent.
So now we have a new victim to defeat, Lion Kamala Harris. Lion, L-Y-I-N apostrophe. She is a radical left lunatic who will destroy our country if she ever gets the chance to get into office. We're not going to let that happen.
So, what else did he have to say while he was here?
Well, I think it's just worth noting that in the last few hours, actually, because we broadcasted this morning, that the Obamas officially came out and endorsed Kamala Harris. And that matters because last night, before everybody went to bed, Donald Trump came out with a statement saying that he was going to actually drop out of the debates as they currently are, because it didn't seem like the Democratic Party was fully on board with Kamala Harris, including the Obamas. So now we're waking up this morning with a new dynamic of, we do not have any set debates, where just a few days ago here in Charlotte, it seemed like Mr. Trump was ready to go. seemed like he was eager, ready to go, as you mentioned, go back to the red meat Donald Trump that his, you know, audience loves, and seemed ready to go. And now it seems like that might not be the case going into September.
Yeah, she says that she is ready to debate him on the same schedule that he arranged with President Biden, which would have put one ABC debate on the air in September. And he is saying that he would rather move it to outlets that are more friendly. In other words, Fox or News Nation or something like that. Eric.
I thought it was interesting. He had the usual or expected invective. He also took time out to say that he favors exceptions to prohibition of abortion in the cases of rape, incest, and the life of the mother. This is obviously a very closely watched issue for the Republicans right now because it is such a motivator for Democratic voters. So I thought that was really interesting.
I also think it's interesting that we were sort of his test audience for his new attacks on Kamala Harris. Like, this is, you know, if there's one thing that Donald Trump does really well is that he frames his opponents. And this was the first time we saw him in public talk about Kamala Harris as the lead on the Democratic ticket, calling her lying Kamala, talking to her about crazy Kamala. Now, whether or not that sticks, as we know, going back to, you know, little Marco back in 2016, some of the things stick, some of them don't. He's going to have to find something that sticks.
So we're the test kitchen for Sarah Lee here. Eli, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, I think we saw that he's going to tie her really directly to Biden's policies. He said she's the force behind all of the things that people have been criticizing Biden for, like inflation and border insecurity. So there's that direct line of attack. And we also saw him try to invert the dynamic of her being a prosecutor and him being a convicted felon. You know, he didn't try to avoid that. He went right at it and tried to flip it and said, yeah, she's a district attorney, but she was the worst ever. So using that Trumpian hyperbole to kind of judo flip the attack there, as we've seen him do for 9 years now.
Well, let's let people hear that, because I've got those quotes there, because the campaign slogans are firming up on both sides of the aisle. We saw that several times this week with Vice President Harris. She began talking about something that she's repeated several times since. I think on Wednesday she spoke to the Biden campaign workers, who are now her campaign workers, and tried this theme out, and she's done it ever since that day, touting her past work as a prosecutor who took in all kinds of criminals.
Predators who abused women. Fraudsters who ripped off consumers. Cheaters who broke the rules for their own gain. So hear me when I say, I know Donald Trump's type.
And as Eli just said, here in Charlotte, Trump picked up his cue.
And she's got a new line, you know, she's going, I'm the prosecutor. She's one of the worst prosecutors in history. She destroyed San Francisco. I'm the prosecutor, and he's the convicted felon or something.
Being a convicted felon is a badge of honor for Donald Trump and for many of his supporters, if not all of them. Is it among the independents whom he must woo in order to win this election?
Well, you know, I think that's still up in the air, but I'll note that both kind of in public and also especially at this rally, there were a lot of people wearing the I'm voting for the felon or mm-hmm. I'm voting for the outlaw shirts. That merch is big. And I think when you look at this race, the J.D. Vance pick shows that at least before Biden dropped out, they weren't really going for wooing the independents. They were thinking, we're going in for the kill here. And, you know, it's worth noting, if you look at North Carolina polling, Trump was still up 6 on the polling averages before Biden dropped out. We'll see if that changes now. I know we're going to talk about Roy Cooper as well. But, you know, if you look at a state like North Carolina, he doesn't have to try to expand his lead here. At this time in 2020 and 2016, Donald Trump was actually behind in North Carolina polling, went on to win the state in close races. Now he is up by a much larger margin in North Carolina than he ever was in those previous races. So I think from their perspective, they don't necessarily have to worry as much about the liberal, independent, or moderate.
Both Ben and Ryan want to get in on this. Ben, go ahead.
I do think, no matter who you who support in this race, the Trump campaign is having to completely reinvent what their strategy is, because just in the last 3 or 4 days, you can see online and on TV, the Harris campaign is going to run a very different, very aggressive, also digitally and social media nimble race that is very quick to jump on memes, very quick to jump on making fun of their opponents like J.D. Vance. It's a very different campaign just in its infancy than the Biden campaign has been this time around and the time before.
It's also fresh and new. This was going to be a contest between two elderly men, and now it's between one elderly man, the oldest man now to have ever run for president, Donald Trump. That's kind of flipping the switch. And this 59-year-old woman who is full of vim and vigor and who appeals to young people, young voters, because she has embraced social media and some of the memes that have been floated about her candidacy. She's embracing those memes. Brian, you tried to get into this a little while ago. I don't know whether we're still where you wanted to talk, but right. Go ahead and put your two cents.
No, yeah, absolutely. In. I think for those reasons that you and Ben just stated, I'm very interested to see how he dodges the upcoming debates, because he got very lucky in winning the last one, not necessarily due to his own performance, but because of Biden's bad performance. And now he's got an entirely different opponent. And I just thought the Obama excuse, I'm not going to debate you because Obama hasn't endorsed you, was such a silly grasp at a reason to dodge that I'm interested to see what he says now that Obama has, as if he was waiting on that as the decider.
Yeah, I was just going to add to what Ben was saying about the freshness of the campaign. The other thing that we can't overlook is since Vice President Harris became the presumptive nominee, they've raised $130 million. That's a lot of money to do a lot of social media and every other kind of media you want to do. So that's another factor to watch in this race as it changes.
And of course, we're very bifurcated. Everybody's in their corners and they're not budging. The people who support the Democrats are supporting the Democrats, and those who support Trump are squarely in his corner. WCNC-TV spoke to a few of those folks gathered for the Trump rally.
Trump. Go Trump!
We've seen it happen the past 3.5 years.
Rallying around Trump as he rallies around us.
It's the biggest crowd I've ever seen in that place, and I've seen some sold-out shows.
It's so important to get somebody great back in the building.
This election is so important because the last 4 years we have been straight rammed into tyranny, and now we are, as Americans, waking up to it, and we're going to throw it off our shoulders.
Okay, I've heard other people talk about the tyranny of the Biden administration. Would somebody please give me an example of that?
I don't know if I can give an example of that, but I can speak to one of the people we just heard from. It was Renee White, and my colleague Richard Devane spoke to her. And it goes to the diehard nature of some of his reporters that he can make the tyranny statements and there's not a lot of pushback. There's not a lot of skepticism that it's met with. This was her 35th Trump rally. She was at the Butler rally a few weeks ago in Pennsylvania. We have video of her. She was directly behind him when the shots were fired. She's from Boone, had driven up there, and now was driving here to be at her 35th rally. It's hard to match that enthusiasm, even if we're talking about Kamala Harris right now and the new enthusiasm and financial support coming behind her. I mean, 35 rallies, I mean, that's impressive.
She's a deadhead.
She is. That's what this is like, honestly.
But for politics, not music.
Yes.
We have a couple of other attendee comments that we gather here at WFAE that we'll play when we come back from the break. We'll also handicap the vice presidential contest on the Democratic side of the ticket and where Roy Cooper stands and all that, possibly, when we come back on the local news roundup here on 90.7 WFAE's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News, is with us along with Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV and host of their Flashpoint program on Sunday mornings. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. The Trump rally attracted around 11,000 or so people, and some of whom we talked to recently before the rally started. And because these people are so into Trump, they're also into politics. They kind of can predict what's happening next. And some of them said that they felt that he would pin Kamala Harris to the what we've already talked about, to many of the things that they blame the Biden administration for.
I think people look at her as an attachment to the last 3 years of the Harris-Biden agenda, the Biden-Harris agenda. It's no secret. I think there's going to be a decent amount of people that maybe not like her, but because they're Democrats and will vote Democrat no matter what, will still support her. But I still think that there's going to be a good amount of people who might be turned off because of that process and how it went down.
I think they gave up already by putting her in.
Yeah, definitely. They know it's a losing battle. It's only 4 months. So they're not going to, there's not enough time. No, not at all.
I think the snowball is rolling with Trump and everybody behind him.
Definitely, we can't go into the election thinking it's going to be a landslide. No matter what competition you're in, you should never underestimate what you're going up against.
So this is late in the campaign, and the result will depend on those in the middle who haven't chosen sides, one would presume. Do we know which side is more likely to bring newcomers to their side of the table?
Now, if we knew that, we would all be on the beach, wouldn't we?
Well,
I think it's going to depend on who she picks as her VP. I don't want to jump the gun here and get to the next topic, but I mean, that's going to be a large part of it, because if you listen to, people like Bitzer and Scott Huffman and all these really smart, political analysts, they'll tell you that, oftentimes somebody will pick a person to run with that balances them out. It doesn't appear that Trump did that with J.D. Vance, except for maybe the age difference. Mr. Vance is half Trump's age. But one way you do that, one way you appeal to those independents would be a VP pick.
Yeah, J.D. Vance is shaping up to be the single most unpopular vice presidential candidate in presidential election history, for whatever the reason. I think a lot of people don't know him, and when they find out about him, they don't like some of his ideas. But he was picked for the Biden-Harris contest, and now it's the Harris-somebody contest. Mm-hmm. And we might as well talk about that, because yesterday, she had reports are that she had narrowed it down to about a dozen candidates for vice president, and yesterday it was revealed she's narrowed it down even further, and North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper continues to make the cut. Whether or not he's chosen as her running mate, he's very much on her side.
She has to win. She has to stop Trump. And I want her to get the very best person she can get as vice president. That being said, I respect her process, and I'm not going to comment on it any further.
But during one of her recent trips to our state, she sang his praises.
It is so good to be back with so many incredible leaders, including my dear friend Roy Cooper. You know, Roy and I served together when I was Attorney General of California, and he was Attorney General of North Carolina. I've known him for almost 2 decades, and he is an extraordinary leader.
So it appeared that Cooper was hoping for a cabinet position in the second Biden administration. Clearly, he and the vice president have a relationship, but he's in what appears to be the final six among people like Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, also an astronaut, that's a pretty big plus, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. Aside from bringing in the second number, highest number of Electoral College votes, because only Pennsylvania in that group of states has more than we do, what does Cooper bring that might get him the nod?
Well, go ahead, Eli. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say he clearly would balance somewhat of the ticket, where you have Harris already being attacked for being a San Francisco, California liberal, as Trump has put it. Cooper obviously is a governor from state that's gone red for a long time, a Democratic governor who works with a Republican legislature and can point to some concrete achievements, bipartisan achievements he'll highlight, like finally getting Medicare expansion over the finish line. So he's got that kind of balance. I also think it would be really interesting to see a Cooper-Vance VP debate. You know, Vance's claim to fame is hillbilly elegy and growing up, you know, as he put it, as a hillbilly. You know, Roy Cooper, I don't think anyone would say is a hillbilly, but he did grow up on a tobacco farm in eastern North Carolina. So it would be pretty interesting to see the two of them go at it and maybe neutralize one of J.D. Vance's strengths.
And sure. I think also picking up on what Eli's saying, you know, Cooper is viewed as more centrist as a candidate, certainly. So that helps because you're already seeing the attacks on Vice President Harris as California liberal. There's just the basic, most obvious male-female balance dynamic. A lot of people seem to want that, rightly or wrongly. So I think Cooper brings several things, but I think one of the biggest hurdles is Pennsylvania, Mike. You mentioned it. I mean, that is the state, and obviously with that state's governor as one of the potential running mates, that has to be pretty attractive to the vice president's campaign, I would think.
Brian.
Right, yeah, and I think it's a huge deal that he's one of these people who's actually inspired people to vote presidential Republican and governor Democrat. That's just such a big deal in 2020 and 2024 at a place where we're at in this country. But also, it can't be ignored that he's just sort of controversy-less. He hasn't really had any scandal. There's nothing that people can point to and attack him. They'll try.
Couldn't the same be said of Roy Cooper, who has also never lost an election?
Mm-hmm. Right. Since the mid-80s, he's undefeated, which is a crazy statistic.
Yeah.
And never had a scandal.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, statistically, there is some number of Trump-Cooper voters out there because Trump won this state in 2016 and 2020. Roy Cooper was elected governor in 2016 and 2020. So there is some percentage of people out there who find Cooper appealing enough to vote for, even though they're Trump voters. And that's got to be something that the campaign maybe thinks about as well.
I've got to think, you know, I know Shapiro's desirable because of Pennsylvania, but he's also a risk in that he's been in statewide office there as governor for I think a year and a half or something like that. So it's not, you compare that to say Roy Cooper, it's not quite the same. You're wanting to make sure you're getting a sure bet here. Now, I mean, I still think Mark Kelly, you know, somebody who's a veteran, who's the son of two police officers, who's an astronaut, who's the husband of Gabby Giffords. I mean, politically speaking, he checks a lot of boxes. He's also in a swing state. He's also considered a moderate. A lot of liberals don't like him because of his pro-business point of view. He, I think, more so than anybody, checks the most boxes.
Eric and then Ryan.
Mike, since we're always in the bad habit of jumping three steps ahead in all of the political handicapping, so let's just say it's Kelly or Shapiro and Vice President Harris becomes the president. I would think Roy Cooper is an obvious candidate to be Attorney General of the United States. But anyway, go on to you, Ryan.
Unless he runs against Tillis for Senate.
That's a good point.
Right. I agree. I just wanted to point out in very getting in the weeds political strategizing, I don't know that the Democratic Party wants to pull a senator out in Mark Kelly and with such a dead heat there or just split Senate. So that might be something they consider not doing.
And Ben, you can become Attorney General for 2 years and then run for Senate because Tillis is not up until 2026.
It's the perfect springboard.
Yeah. So no matter how who's the vice president, here is how Roy Cooper views the Harris-Trump matchup.
Well, he has an opponent who is a prosecutor. He's obviously a criminal. He has an opponent who has protected consumers. He's a con man. He has an opponent who was able to put women's reproductive freedom front and center while he has destroyed Roe v. Wade.
So these are the Democratic talking points, among others. How likely are they to be effective?
Well, you know, we've heard these same themes come out pretty consistently from the Biden campaign and now from the Harris campaign. in their communications and their events, they are really focusing on reproductive rights. Hadley Duvall, who has been a reproductive rights advocate from Kentucky, I believe. She was raped as a child and impregnated at 12. She was in Charlotte on Wednesday, the same day as Trump, in order to deliver kind of a counterpunch there. So I think, especially with Harris at the top of the ticket now, you know, women's rights, reproductive rights are going to be front and center. And, you know, we'll see if that is an issue that still has resonance. You know, we're 2 years out from Roe v. Wade being overturned, which feels like an eternity these days.
Eric.
I go back to what Ben was saying about how Trump has been so effective at framing campaigns and arguments against candidates. That's one of the big questions now with Vice President Harris in this race. Can she do it? You mentioned some of the memes and embracing social media. Can she find a way to, in essence, do to Trump what he has done to others? Remember, when Biden won in 2020, it was much more about, you know, the country's in chaos. There's COVID. We have to do something else. This race is not we have to do something else than Trump. So then what is the argument? How does the vice president frame her campaign, and how does she portray Trump, and can she do it consistently?
Ben.
And she also has to do it quickly. Keep in mind, we've got a couple of weeks here because of the state of Ohio. They have to have a ticket for him by, I think, August 7th, and then the DNC is 2 weeks after that. So what you're going through is like a hypersonic vetting process right now. And Mike, to your point, this is where it's almost, in today's modern media landscape, this is almost like a very public audition process. And you have Andy Beshear, and you have Pete Buttigieg, and you have Mark Kelly and Roy Cooper, each going on different TV shows, each trying out their line of attack. And you know the Harris campaign's watching to see who's effective. And not that that will be the deciding factor, but that will be a factor.
One thing that hasn't come up in all of this is inflation. It's still a problem, although it is coming down, but it seems to be in the back of, or in the forefront of many people's minds, because they can't afford to buy stuff if you're in a budgetary pinch. And I was reading an article about this yesterday on the Washington Post website, and it's because it's on the website, they have responses. And somebody brought up the idea of the grocery prices being the big problem. So the ticket ought to be Harris Teeter. I'm just telling you.
On a long journey.
Now he's going to find Cheater.
So it took out the material for Charlotte Squawks next
time.
That's right.
The Squawk run is over. So
I've joked that like Harris Cooper, Harris Kelly, it all sounds like law firms.
Yeah, it does.
So it took only hours for Democrats to congeal in their support for Vice President Harris. Within 36 hours, she had all of the Democratic governors in the country in her corner. She quickly secured enough delegate pledges to win the nomination at their virtual convention, which is coming up next month. What you've spoken, Ryan, with North Carolina Democrats. What did they have to say about her candidacy and her prospects?
I know Elma Adams held a roundtable on the night after the announcement, and she's very, you know, she's very willing to move on and ready to sort of circle the wagons for Kamala. I know that Anderson Clayton, the North Carolina Democratic Party chair, has been very energized about this. You know, her whole thing is sort of that people pay attention to her because of her young age and her energy and things like that. And I think that fits right in with what Kamala's campaign is trying to sort of express here, that there's a new energy behind them. And that's a big deal in North Carolina, where there's a lot of young Democrats who are trying to make a big run here.
And there is some concern I read yesterday in North Carolina circles of what a Cooper run for vice president might mean for the state and for what Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, who is running to replace Cooper at the top of the ticket, might do in his absence. Because evidently in North Carolina, if you are the governor and you leave the state, the lieutenant governor is the acting governor. And in one of his absences, the lieutenant governor, Mark Robinson, tried to pull a fast one. Is that likely to happen during an election cycle?
I don't think so. I mean, he may try and pull a fast one, but there's really not much he can do with Cooper out of the state. And as one expert said this week, you know, Cooper can pretty much come back to town and undo whatever it is that was that occurred temporarily. So it's an interesting story to look at, but I think tangibly not a lot would change.
Yeah, and this is something, you know, that happens every time Cooper leaves the state anytime. So it's not that different. He would just be leaving the state, presumably to campaign a little more frequently.
So meanwhile, speaking of Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, there's been some back and forth between the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services and Robinson over just how his wife's nonprofit child care center, Precious Beginnings, operated. The department alleges that the center attempted to falsify information. And this week, DHHS released a report that found that a different nonprofit, also run by the Lieutenant Governor's wife, Balanced Nutrition, was, quote, seriously deficient, and they found a long list of missing documents required to administer a federally funded food program, as well as claims filed for payment for centers that apparently hadn't requested or received that money. What is this all about, Eric?
Well, I think it's, on its face, it's part of a pattern of serious mismanagement of businesses by Robinson's family, which some he's been involved in, I assume at least to some degree with all of them. And remember, there was that investigation, was it ABC News, who reported that Robinson did not file federal income taxes for 5 years in a row. So there are a lot of personal financial aspects of Mark Robinson's life that are worth scrutinizing, and that's what we're seeing.
So with the Child Development Center, there were documents that they claim they filed that the DHHS department has no record of having ever filed. DHHS also says that Balanced Nutrition, the other business now, failed to file valid claims for 9 of the facilities it was working with, didn't maintain required enrollment documentation or documentation related to required training, free and reduced lunch eligibility, many of which DHHS described as repeat findings. Balanced Nutrition also accused of not getting permission to hire family members, and both the lieutenant governor worked for that business before his ascension into politics, as did their daughter. In both cases, Robinson's wife closed these operations once the investigations began. He has denied any problems with either of these businesses. Is this going to become a campaign issue in 25 seconds or less?
Yes, I think it is. At the same time, though, it's kind of like we're seeing with Trump, where it's almost better to have an endless stream of problems and scandals than to have one pop up. It's kind of noise that people are like, oh, another Robinson problem. Okay.
Is this any way to run a country? All right. We have to take a break. We'll come back with the CMPD crime stats and more in a moment in Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ryan Pitkin is here. He's co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV and host of their Flashpoint program on Sunday mornings. And Eli Portillo is senior editor here at WFAE News. Homicides and violent crime are down throughout the nation. We've talked about this a lot in recent weeks, and in most large cities, crime is down, but not in Charlotte. While property crime here remained flat through June, violent crimes continue to rise, especially homicide. CMPD says violent crime is up 8% this year. Assaults with deadly weapons have risen 9%. Homicides are up 36% in the first half of the year.
The increase in gun violence and homicides point to a larger societal problem. It's going to take much more than the police. It's going to take investing in communities and investing in prevention and alternatives to violence, particularly among young people.
CMPD Deputy Chief David Robinson, haven't we been making those investments in young people and prevention of violence and alternative to violence programs for years now?
Yes, we have.
And are they not working?
I think it's a mixed bag, Mike. I mean, you know, when you talk about societal overhaul, for lack of a better term, there's so much that goes into that. I don't think you can instantly say that they're not working because the problem persists. For starters, look at the proliferation of guns. We have never, as a country or as a state or as a community, gotten a handle on all the guns that are flooding into the streets. And that's certainly, if not the top problem, it's one of the top three. So you could start with that.
And Deputy Chief,
I spoke to the mother of a young man who was shot and killed by some classmates. I think it was last January. And I asked her that problem, like, what are we doing wrong? Her response was interesting, and her other kids, this boy's siblings agreed, and they said social media. They said that it plays a profound sense because you have people, young people who talk a big game on social media and dare each other on social media, and start to think that that's real, and it proliferates this whole sort of confrontational aspect that you don't even see necessarily on public social media, but on DMs and things like that. And also behavior that they try to mimic from others. It was an interesting perspective that I hadn't thought about in terms of specifically, you know, homicides or serious crime.
Which could help to gin up tensions and resentments, et cetera. And part of this is because people don't like to be disrespected, and so they pull out their gun and use it. Deputy Chief Robinson pointed to one particularly disturbing statistic. There have been 12 juveniles charged with homicide this year compared to 3 at the same time last year. And he said the number of repeat juvenile offenders has pointed to an undeniable need for more accountability post-arrest and to house juvenile offenders in a detention facility locally. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden closed the county's juvenile jail facility a while ago. Is that a contributing factor? Is that what the police are saying about this?
Ben, yeah, that is what the police...
Yeah, and he says he needs more money from Tim Moore. And when I asked Tim Moore about it last time, I said, the House Speaker up in North Carolina, he said he didn't know anything about it. So the sheriff will say, yes, he would like to reopen that jail north. But it's not quite clear where the money comes from and who's responsible.
So are young people not being sent to jail while they're awaiting trial? Is that what's going on here because they closed that facility, or are they being sent out of town? And that's the problem. Why would that be a problem?
Well, it's yes to both. The police pointed to both the raise the age law, which is being partially rolled back, which meant that 16, 17-year-old juveniles charged with serious crimes like, you know, shootings and such were not automatically in adult court. So it is more difficult to hold them. The police also pointed to, I believe they said there have been 62 instances this year where they have requested a juvenile be detained after being arrested for a serious offense, and they were turned down, and that juvenile was released to the custody of their parents. So that's something that they're pointing at. But to your other part of the question, when juveniles are detained, yes, they are being sent out of the county, you know, to an hour and a half, even farther away, which I think is pretty bad for, you know, a 16-year-old who's being held an hour and a half from family and any support services they might get. So it's kind of a problem on both ends there.
It's very complex, and it's all interconnected, and many people say that poverty plays a major role in this as well. And several years ago, Charlotte leaders were stunned by something called the Land of Opportunity Study, also known as the Chetty Study, named after the Harvard University professor who spearheaded this. And in that study, we ranked 50th out of 50 U.S. cities for upward mobility. It said that if you were born poor in Charlotte, chances are you would die poor here. And now a new Chetty study has been conducted, and it has some better news. What does it tell us, Ben?
We are now number 38, which still means we have a long way to go, but much like youth violence, I mean, economic mobility is a complicated issue, and anybody who knows it will tell you that. So trying to solve it is not easy. So the fact that we have a city that's moved 12 places up, you know, a lot of city leaders, civic leaders, community leaders, feel pretty good about it. I mean, when it came out, you know, we're used to being at the top of the most sought after lists of best places to live, best places for millennial, fastest growing cities. And so when this came out, it sort of rocked the community because we're not used to being at the bottom of lists. And so with Leading on Opportunity and other organizations and the Mayor's Racial Initiative, contributions to the Housing Trust Fund, they feel like they have actually really started to make a dent in this to make sure that if you're born in poverty, that does not mean that you're going to be subjected and stuck in poverty the rest of your life here in Charlotte.
Lots of government and non-governmental organizations sprang into action on the heels of that last study. Millions of dollars were raised. Programs were designed and implemented. Are they taking credit for the what has just happened and been revealed in this new study?
Yeah, I think, as Ben was saying, there is a lot of optimism, and a lot of the groups Leading on Opportunities, one of them, they measure and track the progress, are saying that these programs have been effective. What I heard from a lot of people yesterday talking about this is there is a lot of work, obviously, still left to be done, but they are most encouraged by two things. One, that you now have measurable, tangible evidence that these programs are working. But secondly, and I think more important, is that in Charlotte, we have a tendency to take on some civic cause for 6 months to a year and then forget about it. With this one, really since 2017, after that community study followed the original Chetty study, the local government, philanthropy, business, they've all stuck to this pretty closely and framed philanthropy in terms of how do you lift economic mobility. So those are some encouraging signs.
Ryan.
Yeah, I thought one of the most intriguing parts of this report was just the quick stat, and it's wonky how they figure all this out, but they named us number 3 out of those 50 cities in progress being made. So it just goes to show that what Eric was just saying, that these programs were confronted head on, and they seem to be making a difference in some way or shape or form.
Eli.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about the methodologies of this study and what it looks at. You know, the original Chetty study was looking at the outcomes of kids who were born in the late 70s, early 80s. This study is looking at the outcomes for kids who were born in the early 90s, about 15 years later. So we're kind of saying we're 38 as of 1992. So yes, that looks better, but we're not looking at, you know, kids who were born when the Chetty study came out in 2014, which of course we're not, because they're 10 right now. They're not out earning money and having jobs.
But remember, Eli, this is looking at them at age 27. So you're really looking at 2019.
Right. So we're saying from 1992 to 2019, we were the number 38 city. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are interpreting it, you know, kind of prospectively into the future, saying like we're 38 and now a kid born today has a better chance. We don't know what the kid born today has a chance of. And because of the way this study looks at kids over, you know, almost 30 years of their life, we won't know how the kids born today are doing until, you know, 30 years from now. And that's an issue that people have kind of pointed at with these Chetty studies for a while.
And what I'm hearing you say is this is apples and oranges comparison here. Could they look at the original group of people and see if their prospects have improved in any way as a result of all the programs and the money spent?
Sure they could. Yeah. Yeah.
Why don't
they?
The
answer is yes. That's a question for Raj Chetty. You'll have to have him on next week.
Well, the question that they've been trying to look at that Chetty is really interested in is what do we need to do for kids to set them up with good chances? Right. And that's a complaint that I've heard from some leaders is, okay, that's great, but there's no way to measure that until the kids are 27, 30. So it's hard to tell what we're seeing now and what that looks like.
The big takeaway here is that Atlanta is now 50th in this latest study. That's the big takeaway.
And that's something everybody can be excited about, right?
That's right. We spent a lot of time talking about Joe Biden's sudden decision to not seek re-election. In fact, the nation has been consumed with it. We took the first 30 minutes of this program to talk about the ramifications of that. But something has happened in North Carolina that nobody has noticed. I don't think very few people have noticed. Did North Carolina Representative Lincoln County's Jason Sain, one of the top Republicans in the House, has decided to resign. Why, Eli?
I believe Eric is the expert.
Okay,
on this
Eric,
one.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh God, the pressure's on. He has said a couple things. He has a son who is in high school. He wants to spend more time with him, but he also wants to go into the private sector, and he has a couple options there. And he may do some lobbying. I think that's very likely. So all those things combined to convince him to step down as of August 12th.
And you report that despite being from a rural area, Lincoln County, he was a steadfast believer that lifting the Charlotte region benefits everybody and making him a key ally for Charlotte and for Mecklenburg County. How did he help us?
Yeah, it's been really interesting on a number of economic development type issues. He went to bat for Charlotte. It doesn't hurt that he is the senior chair of the Appropriations Committee, which is very powerful. He has Charlotte connections. He went to UNC Charlotte. But still, when you look at the tension between Republican leadership in Raleigh and the Democratic-led local government in Mecklenburg County in Charlotte, we know how that's played out over years and years. And what Jason Sain has done is he has gone to a pragmatic view of this, and he has spoken to his Republican colleagues and said, look, when Charlotte benefits, everybody gets some ripple effect of benefit. And so that kind of cools the temperature a little bit on the great state of Mecklenburg.
We are just hours away, as Ben will tell you, from the opening ceremonies at the Paris Olympics. They'll be on WCNC-TV at 1:30 this afternoon, and they will repeat them in primetime tonight at 7:30 on the networks of NBC, the Paris Summer Olympic Games. We have several North Carolina and Charlotte area athletes in those games, including, is it Lyle or Leal Abada?
Leal.
A soccer dude, Leal Abada. Yep. He's Charlotte FC's forward who represents Israel in these games. Hannah Aspden, a Raleigh native and Queen's University of Charlotte alumna, heading into her third Paralympic game. She'll be competing in swimming. Who else from this area will be in
we
the games?
Sierra Burdick. She's a basketball Charlotte native, went to Butler High. Nia Tapper, rugby, went to West Mech. Anna Cockrell, the name a lot of us know. She actually competed in Tokyo, was disqualified for a lane violation, went to Providence Day. Father, well-known around these areas as well. There's a lot of local, not only Charlotte, Carolina athletes headed over there.
And as luck would have it, Charlotte native Anna Cockrell, who is a Providence Day alumnus, is competing in the 400-meter hurdle. She made it, as you said, into the Olympics last time around, only to be disqualified during the games for a lane violation. Charlotte Talks producer Sarah D'Elia spoke with her in 2021 about her Olympics experience and about her keeping her eyes on these Paris games.
I am so much better at just celebrating the little victories. Going to the Olympics is not a little victory. It's a big victory. But even if I didn't go, you know, even if I didn't make the team, I think I would still be in a good place about it, because at the end of the day, there are so many things that I wanted to do that I achieved. And I did it in a way that was not detrimental to my health. It was not detrimental to my self-esteem or my self-worth.
And I know, Ryan, you wanted to talk about Nia Tapper, who is in the rugby division of the Olympics this time around.
Yeah, I just think her story is really cool because she went to West Mech where she was a track star. So if any of her classmates learned she was in the Olympics, they'd say, of course she is. But she's actually co-captain of the rugby team because she went to UNC Chapel Hill, took that sport up, and is now a huge leader for the country. They're far from favorites, but that's sort of my underdog story. I want to see them do well because she's going to retire at the end of these games.
And, of course, Steph Curry is also playing.
He's kind of a big deal.
Kind of a big deal. A word of warning, and we only have 30 seconds, but a word of warning, you may find what you're about to hear troubling. Panthers training camp began this week. What do we know, Eric, in 15 seconds or less?
We know that they're now in Charlotte, so you can go out and see them easily. They were in Spartanburg at Wofford College for years and years, but now they're going to be in Charlotte every year. And look, hope springs eternal, at least in July and August in the NFL, so we'll see what happens come fall.
Do you have to pay to get into the training camp?
I don't believe you have to pay to get into the training camp. You might even get to play based on the way things are going.
Well, if you've been to a Hornets game in the past, here's a voice you certainly heard.
And now, Varsity, get on your feet and greet your Charlotte Hornets.
the remarkable and energizing voice of Big Pat Doughty, who died this week. He was the announcer in the arena for almost 20 years, ever since the Bobcats came to Charlotte, and he told WSOC-TV's Phil Urban that he got the job even though he wasn't one of the 500 people invited to audition.
What I did was put a voicemail of begging in about 10 different voicemail boxes, and 2 days later I got a call, and they said, listen, Mr. Doughty, come on down, we're going to let you audition. But we're not going to give you per diem, so you're not going to have money to eat with. We're not going to give you a hotel room. Oh, and you need to be here tomorrow by 6 o'clock.
And if you heard him in the arena, he was part of the show. I mean, he created the show in many ways. Even team members felt his energy. And Big Pat said that went both ways.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.